Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. And this week, we're talking about school choice, a portfolio of options, charters, vouchers, virtual classrooms. This is the vocabulary of the 21st century American education system. And having more of these private options is exactly what policymakers like Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos would like to see. But where did the idea of school choice or public charter schools or any of these things really come from? And what kind of impact does siphoning money from the public education system have on the students who are left in that system, or the ones who are now taking virtual geometry classes in their kitchens? And how do race and class tie into the issue of where a kid goes to school? Nolewe Rooks tackles these questions in her new book, Cutting School: Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. As her subtitle and a whole host of studies suggest, American schools are becoming just as segregated as they were in the middle of the 20th century, when Brown v. Board of Education was first decided. And the origin of charter schools, far from being a mid-80s technocratic dream, seemed to have played a big part in that from the very first segregation academies that opened in the wake of Brown v. Board of Education. So the story is way darker than it first appears, and to really understand what's changed in the last 50 years, we have to go back to the beginning. Here to do that is Nolewe Rooks, who joined us from Cornell University, where she's the Director of American Studies. Thanks so much for talking to us, Nolewe.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
So can you set the stage for us and give us a history of how our approach to public education has changed over the past 60 years?
Yeah, the moment of Brown really is, it's the moment that I think in American history books and most of American consciousness, we really think that there was this massive change that took place, and it was massive. Brown is actually a sort of midway point between the beginning of American education, which is much more a story pre-Brown about class. From the 1880s on, it really was the case that only the wealthy were even considered eligible to get any kind of education. Poor whites were shut out of schoolhouses as much as anyone else. And there was no state taxpayer-supported state education. That just didn't even come about until Reconstruction, about the end of the Civil War, where money was really shifted from the supposed education of newly freed slaves to the education of poor whites. Brown changed all of that. It was really not just the case that it was about the color of children. It had to do with an economic realignment, with allowing people of African descent, people who had been formerly enslaved, to have full access to the dollars so that public funds would be used equally. And this was a complete and total sea change. So moving forward from Brown, the South engaged in what they call massive resistance to the idea of integrated schools. And so most people don't know, if they haven't studied it, it's not the way that history gets taught very often in high schools or middle schools. Brown was not actually enacted until the mid to late 60s, at which point the federal government said, we will no longer give you any money if you continue to resist racial integration. And then you saw the South start to integrate. But what happened was the 64 Civil Rights Act also exempted Northern school districts, because Northern school districts had never had written into law that you cannot have black and white students sitting in classrooms together. There was residential segregation, ideas about who could go to what school, but it was never the case that the North was any more interested in integration, quite frankly, than was the South. It was just they weren't under any kind of order. Nonetheless, by the 80s, or actually the 70s, you started to see different government agencies and commissions come along and say, we really think that this whole integration experiment has gone entirely too far in the entire country. And you had business leaders who were working with elected officials and saying, you know, what no one has noticed, said the people who authored this report, is that American schools as a whole are now horrible. They're falling off the map. We're testing worse than we ever have. Literacy rates are lower than they've ever been before. And so this is, you know, we need to move away from these efforts to integrate schools because it's harming business. It's harming our standing. We can no longer find workers. And we need to turn schools toward business, which sort of opens the door for this period, the more contemporary, I'd say the 1990s forward, where education is now firmly segregated, so firmly segregated by race and or class.
Right. And you coin a term to talk about this, segronomics, which you define as the business of profiting specifically from high levels of racial and economic segregation. But how is that actually profitable? How has money undermined the integration efforts of the past century, however half-hearted they may have been?
When I started the book, it was going to be in about the 21st century because I was teaching at Princeton and there were so many young, enthusiastic, upper-class white kids who all of a sudden were having conferences or coming and taking classes or wanting to talk about urban education, education in highly segregated, very poor cities, Newark, New Jersey, Trenton, New Jersey, Philadelphia, South Bronx of New York. Like this became their whole conversation about, well, you know, this is a civil rights issue. And it was breathtaking. And I wanted to write about that. I wanted to talk about, you know, all of these kids coming up with these ideas that were turning into businesses like Teach for America or like the KIPP charter schools in particular. And I started to notice, though, that there were few of these young people who knew anything about these communities that they wanted to work in. They didn't know anything about poor rural communities. They'd not gone to public schools. If they went to public schools, they were highly financed public schools. They didn't know much about the communities or schools that they were now saying they were going to go in and fix. And so I really started to just think about, but then what is this big motivation? Not that it was even bad. Like, it's not a bad thing. It's great. You know, the more attention that we can get into suffering people. You know, we need more of that, not less. But what I started to notice is that there was a whole business element to it where philanthropies, the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, the Walton Family Fund, along with government policies and corporations, were doing an awful lot to remake education policy, like multi-billionaires who have decided that they know what needs to happen to remake a public education system that they neither participate in nor send their children to. We, Betsy DeVos, our Secretary of Education, and how limited they are in even trying to seek out advice from those communities about what has worked, what does need to change. But what they were proposing, like closing traditional public schools and expanding charter schools, expanding the alternatively certified teaching corps like Teach for America and others, so much of that didn't work. And all of these became clear were business models. They may have started from a desire to do some good, but they quickly became highly lucrative businesses. So Teach for America in 2016, the last time I was paying attention, you know, was a company worth $270 million. And so in looking at it further, what you saw was, all of these businesses dependent on struggling urban school districts or rural school districts in order to work. They call them 90-90-90 schools. So there's schools that are 90% poor, below federally set poverty levels, 90% Black or Latino, and 90% are falling below federal standards for educational attainment. That is what they were talking about as their sweet spot. That was their growth spot. That's what they needed in order to have the biggest impact, as well as return the biggest kind of investment. So it wasn't that big a jump from that to sort of say, but then this profit is a profit from poverty. It's a profit from segregation. And it's coming up with a bunch of forms, educational forms, that are basically educational experiments. You know, we have no history with them. They're new. They call them innovation, right? These are innovations. Which should be a good thing, except that you're innovating with poor children of color. And when your innovations or your experiments fail, you know, the consequences are devastating. And yet businesses are profiting from that.
Right. And the argument that they tend to advance, I mean, just like you mentioned with the, you know, the college kids at Princeton, is that they're giving back, right? They're offering choices, or like free market innovations, or freedom from government regulation.
Yes.
What's so poisonous about those things? Like, why are those things not actually a benefit to poor minority families?
So that's the thing. When you say that you want to make technology available to communities that have been historically excluded, on its face, you have no reason to think that that's anything but a good. The problem comes when you look at the impact of these various forms. So for charter schools, for example, the last numbers that I saw was there's about almost a quarter, about 22 to 25% of public charter schools are performing better than public schools, are in fact demonstrably providing something that you couldn't find elsewhere in these kinds of communities. But what that means, though, is that there's 75%, three quarters of them are doing worse. And this is taxpayer money that's being spent, hundreds of millions of dollars. And the FBI is consistently finding graft, theft, misrepresentation. So the question is, how is something that only a quarter of which is successful being prescribed as an alternative to traditional public schools, which are doing at least as well as the vast majority? In the city of Philadelphia, it was their goal to have three quarters of the students be educated with virtual schools. So in 2014, however, 100% of the children who took the state achievement test, who had been attending these virtual schools, failed. 100% failed.
Wow.
So the question becomes, why do we only focus on these experiments that are successful? And why is there so little conversation about how many of them are not? Why is public education being dismantled without asking if it's working? It's just basic questions. Is it working? And why are these forms being allowed to continue to expand? And the answer just kept coming back to, it's money. It's good business.
What's really interesting to me, too, is that the origin of school choice, of charter schools, essentially, in the South was fundamentally kind of racist to begin with, because it was meant to create this private option for poor white kids that was publicly funded.
Right. Right. Following Brown v. Board, like really literally the model, the economic model that we see in existence today around that for vouchers as well as charter schools comes in the aftermath, where you had a bunch of wealthy white parents, elite white parents, as well as elected officials. These are all white people. It's not even casting aspersions. They literally are, in fact, all white people who decide that what the Supreme Court has done is taken their rights away from them. These parents really were kind of like, but who are they to tell us, you know, how we should feel, what we believe in a society that's based on these ideas of white supremacy and Black inferiority. And so as a backlash to Brown v. Board, they use the thinking of an economist, Milton Friedman, who have been talking about how basically democracy, expanding citizenship and democracy to others, was actually helping to undermine capitalism and impinged on individual rights. So for white parents in the South, they were like, yes, our individual rights have been impinged upon. We don't feel good about it. So what they did was they began to legislate laws that allowed them to take money out of the traditional public school system. Sometimes they just closed the traditional public school system for years. They were like, if you're going to make us integrate, then there will be no public schools. But in the aftermath of that, they took the money that was earmarked for public education, made it available to white parents, allow them to use their property taxes, whatever amount of money they spent on property taxes, to send their child to what was called segregation academies. So they opened a chain of public schools that were privately run but publicly funded, which is the exact model for vouchers as well as charter schools. They're privately run, which means you're exempt from the laws at the time, you know, saying that you have to integrate. Well, it's a private school. You don't have to integrate. It's just publicly funded. So in one instance in Virginia, one of the headmasters of one of these schools talked about how, you know, he and the people setting up one of these segregation academies literally went to the public high school. And he says, you know, I'm paraphrasing, something like, we took everything except the football goals. Wow. We took all the infrastructure, put it in our private school that are now all white. And the majority of money funding it is either philanthropy donations from whites around the country or these public funds. But blacks were forbidden from doing the same thing. So they did not make it possible for black families to say, OK, fine, we, too, will take our tax dollars. And we, too, will open, you know, segregation accounts. We'll just reinstitute separate but equal. But they were forbidden from participating. So for the districts that just shut down public education, what that meant in terms of educational access and the future of people in this entire region was very much based on race. 75% of white children, even in the school districts that got closed down, still received an education. Something like 20% of blacks did. And the White Citizens Council, which was a white supremacist organization, an offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan, set up a chain of these segregation academies throughout the 13 former slaveholding states. So they were, in a way, like the first charter schools. That's the history. That's where it comes from.
Literally run by the Klan.
It was literally. Like, the White Citizens Council was not exactly the Klan, but they were first cousins.
Wow. So, I mean, it seems pretty clear in that instance that the desire to separate private from public education and segregate kids in that way was definitely racially motivated. But there have been some stories in the past couple years of school systems that have tried integration and done it in a way that seems to work, either inadvertently or accidentally. What else works? What are the success stories? How are public schools trying to fix this huge problem?
Well, the big success stories, one, you know, everybody has figured out that Head Start is vitally important. It is vitally important for all communities to have their 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds have access pre-kindergarten. Those can be segregated spaces. Those don't have to be integrated spaces. But it has to happen and it has to be available. And it's not cheap to make it happen. But when it does, you really set children off on a very strong path. The other thing that we're looking at and starting to see some real good come from are the what they call community schools or renewal schools, some of them. So they have wraparound services. They have smaller classes. They are attempting to educate poor kids and struggling kids in the same kinds of ways that wealthy kids get educated. You have teachers who are around. But you also, you know, you have things to make sure everybody has glasses when they need them.
Right.
Make sure people have enough food so they're not sitting there hungry. You make sure that the infrastructure of the schools have heat. And the numbers of stories that I saw and wrote about in public schools where the schools themselves were, you know, having sewage backing up in the halls or children huddling under blankets in, you know, 2016 outside of Philadelphia because the heating system didn't work. You know, so these wraparound schools sort of make sure your infrastructure is straight. And then on top of it, having smaller classes, more attentive teachers is doing a lot to close the achievement gap. Like those kinds of interventions actually do work. The issue is in this political climate, we simply don't want to spend money on poor people. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's poor people, the educational forms that we're most comfortable with make money for companies. We don't have to spend extra money, extra tax money to help those populations. And that seems to really be a dividing line that we will have to get over if we want to have more to do more of what we know works consistently.
Obviously, it is very difficult to fit 150 years of history into a 20-minute podcast interview. So for more, do check out Nalewe Rooks' book, Cutting School. That's it for Smarty Pants this week. Next week, we are talking to Phil Clay about a runaway hit of an essay he had in our last winter issue. So till then, take care and stay sharp.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.